As usual, let me start by asking whether people have any questions or things you want to discuss what we did last class. All right. How about the reading for this class? Yes.
In the article, earlier on, you had an example of a marriage contract.
Yep.
I didn't understand when you said a partial solution to that was to postpone childbearing.
Yes.
And shift the cost. How does her postponing childbearing shift the cost of the money?
The argument... Oh, it isn't. There are two different things. This is really coming out of an article by Lloyd Cohen, which the subtitle was "I Gave Him the Best Years of My Life." I forget what the title was. And his basic argument is that in a traditional marriage, where the husband is supporting the family and the wife is running the household and bearing and bringing up children, that the mother's part of that is heavily weighted towards the early years of the marriage. That producing babies is a lot of work, taking care of babies is a lot of work. On the other hand, if you're a 40-year-old woman and your kids are in high school and even later in college, well, you're still running the household, but basically you're practically retired. Whereas from the standpoint of the husband, generally men's wages go up as they get older and go further in their career. And therefore, in the early years, the husband is contributing money, but not very much money. By the time they're both about 40, the wife's done most of her share of the joint project. The husband has got large payoffs still coming in the next 20 years if he gets a good income. So he dumps his wife, marries an attractive 23-year-old, and thus, in effect, is reneging on the contract. That's the problem of a situation where you've got two parties to a contract. One of them performs early, one of them late. So the one who is going to perform late can cheat the other one by breaking the contract after the first party performs before the second. One solution is that she spaces out childbearing more. So instead of, if you think about her contribution, instead of her contribution being something like this, she can make it something more like that. That is to say, she starts having children later, she maybe has more space between them. And the other solution is that instead of most of the cost of taking care of children being done by the mother, some noticeable amount of it is done by a nanny or a preschool or some other method of shifting costs to the market, at which point some of that is really a cost to his income rather than a cost to her time. Does that make sense? So basically, Lloyd Cohen's argument is to start out in a world where divorce is hard. And you have a binding contract which has these characteristics that the wife does the bulk of her contribution to the marriage in the early years and the husband the bulk of his in the later years. You then shift to easy divorce. And at this point it becomes possible for husbands to renege on the deal by dumping their wives halfway through the marriage, essentially. Now he says, that's only the middle of the story, because now he says women... observe this situation and they start altering their behavior accordingly. And one way to alter is not to get married. The marriage looks like a less attractive deal than it used to. Another way of altering it is to have a career of your own, minimize the amount of your time and effort that goes into being a wife as opposed to being a co-earner for the household. So if you want to have children, well, physically bearing children, almost everybody does themselves, although you can subcontract that out too nowadays via host mothers. But yeah, that wasn't common when Floyd was writing. But you could have children, hire a nanny when the children are infants to do most of the child care, use preschool when the children are 3, 4, or 5 to do it, and so forth. Hire a housekeeper or people who come in once a week to clean the house, go out to restaurants more often instead of cooking dinner. You can think of a whole lot of ways in which the traditional household production could be shifted to the market. And my impression is, I think whether he's right about the causation, I don't know, but I think if you look at the actual patterns of what happens, my impression is that we and the people we know eat at restaurants a lot more often than our parents did. And that my adult son makes a lot more use of higher child care than we did, let alone than my parents did. And so his suggestion is that these are sort of economically rational responses to a changed set of incentives when the long-term contract became unenforceable. Alright? And marriage, to me, is a nice example of a contract that is inherently hard to enforce because the relevant terms are largely unobservable by third parties. So that, and that gets to the story I know I told you before, but I've got it in the article from Al-Tanuki, 10th century, I think, about the woman who threatens to force her husband to divorce her. And part of what makes that sort of a striking story is that Islamic law, in fact, as well as popularly perceived, is pretty heavily biased towards the male, that the husband can divorce his wife for no cause at all. I don't think there is a legal procedure for the wife divorcing her husband, though I'm not positive of that. And I know that in Jewish law, which has got a good deal in common with that, which I know more about, traditionally the husband could divorce his wife, although he had to give her back certain assets that essentially were, as it were, a bond posted when she got married. And traditionally, in some sense, there is still no way in Jewish law in which a wife can divorce her husband. That the way in which that changed about 1,000 years ago was that the legal authorities decided that the wife could petition a court to order her husband to divorce her. So that, and the court could threaten the husband to lock him up if he didn't, to punish him in various ways. But it was still the case that it had to be the husband divorcing the wife, not the wife divorcing the husband. And that's still a problem, because for people who are actually under traditional Jewish law, because suppose the husband isn't there. Suppose the husband has vanished. You don't know if he died or ran away or whatever. The court can't force him to divorce the wife. And there is the wife who can't be legally remarried because she's still married. There's some term in Hebrew which I don't remember for that situation. Anyway, but the point of the story really is that, to me at least, is that even in a society biased that far, it's taken for granted by the guy who's telling the story, and assuming it's a true story, by the vizier in the story, that even though he's a much more important, powerful person than the husband and wife, it isn't practical for him to make the wife be a good wife to the husband. And that therefore she can force the husband to divorce her by being a nag, you know, cooking everything he doesn't like, whatever you could think of a list of what you would do if you were married and didn't want to be and had to get the other person to divorce you. And therefore the solution is give the husband some money and now she won't want to divorce him because now he's rich too. All right? So that's one. I've got a couple of medieval Islamic law and econ stories, and that's one of them, which I'm rather fond of. Yes?
I had three questions that the article raised in my mind, and I just wanted to get them all out there.
Right.
First one was, reputation seems to work pretty well when a simple issue, well within the ken of your average person on the street. How does it work for very complex problems where the issues are not easily understood by most people? Also, I had a question about does reputational enforcement lead to opportunistic cheating by those who have garnered large amounts of reputation against those who have no reputation or against those who have bad reputations? And lastly, why wasn't the role of morality mentioned in the article? Because it seems like morality is another potential solution.
Yeah. Let me take them one at a time. The first point, I think my answer to your first question is arbitration. That the reputational enforcement works in the simple version if, as you say, it can be obvious to third parties who's cheated. It doesn't work in complicated cases, you're right by that. But even if it isn't obvious to me who cheated, it could still be obvious to me that you agreed that she would arbitrate your dispute and then refuse to abide by her ruling. So arbitration, as I interpret it, is largely a mechanism for reducing costs to third parties. Now, it's complicated. In modern U.S. law, arbitration agreements are normally enforced in the courts. That hasn't always been the case. It isn't always the case in the international context, depending on the countries involved. And I think even in the modern U.S. case, that isn't always the real mechanism of enforcement. And my impression from reading Lisa Bernstein's stuff on the diamond industry a long, long time ago, and I think I'm misremembering it, is that those people who didn't want to go to court. but in part because it was proprietary information of what was going on in that market that you want out. In the early period, because they were Orthodox Jews and they regarded suing a fellow Orthodox Jew as sinful, essentially, I think. So in that case, as far as I can tell, the real enforcement was straightforward reputation, but using an arbitrator in order to get the reputation information to them. And still is. I gather that the Diamond Dealers Club, or Association, whatever it's called in New York, is still in business, is still sort of a combination social institution, judicial institution, that sort of thing. I gather, this is not my field of specialties. Your second question was opportunistic cheating on reputation. That clearly is a potential problem. And again, that would suggest that if you're worried about forms of cheating you can't easily prove, which is, gets back to your first question, you then need someone else's reputation, such as an arbitrator, so that you can use to say, well, yes, I may be a bad guy, but she says that he cheated, and everybody knows that she's a reliable source of information, and that then damages your reputation. But no, I'm sure there are. In fact, it's an interesting case. It's not exactly the same thing. But I had a blog post quite a long time ago, back during the Thomas hearings for the Supreme Court, where I was comparing that case to the Algiers case. How many people here know what the Algiers case was? This was one of the great political controversies of, I suppose, the late 1940s, roughly. Algiers was a very prominent liberal intellectual who had been a part of the State Department, and I think at the time of these things happened, had I think just been appointed or was about to be appointed president of the Carnegie Endowment for Women, or one of the big nonprofit things. And there was a man called Whitaker Chambers who appears out of nothing a few years ago, before that. It turns out that, among other things, he was the translator of Bambi. So I don't know if anybody was aware of that then, from Italian, which was written, I assume all of you read Bambi at some point, some things in translation. But Chambers appears from nowhere, and there's essentially no record of what he's doing like for the previous 15 years or so. He is sufficiently talented so that in a couple of years he's assistant editor of Times Magazine. He then announces that in fact what he was doing was that he was an underground communist. And he warns people that Alger Hiss was also a communist and indeed was feeding. I don't think safety at that point he said was feeding. And this ends up, it's not the McCarthy hearings, but one of the, I think, a set of congressional hearings that preceded the McCarthy hearings, in which Nixon was actually involved as a congressman, in which Hiss and Chambers are called to testify. Hiss denies all of it, claims either he never knew Chambers or he knew him very slightly in some context. Chambers gives us quite detailed account, according to which he knew Hiss very closely for a long period of time, and Hiss was a source of information. And eventually, Hiss sues Chambers for slander, or slander, I don't know which it was, and Chambers wins. Chambers, in the process of winning, produces microfilms of State Department documents with, I think, Hiss's handwriting on it, or typed on a typewriter that Hiss owned, which he had concealed. Chambers' view of the story was that initially he was deliberately not accusing Hiss of anything illegal. What he wanted to do was to warn people not to get Hiss into trouble, because he's a friend of his, but when he was threatened with this legal suit, he brings out the heavy artillery and basically provides convincing evidence that Hiss was deliberately feeding an enemy power secret information. Hiss is tried for perjury, convicted, and spends a few years in jail. And it was a big cause to labor. It was what struck me comparing it to the Thomas case is that the basic logic of both cases is the same. You have a prominent person who is accused of what's essentially professional treason. Right? Thomas is accused of sexual harassment when he's running the federal organization to prevent sexual harassment, essentially. Hiss is accused as a State Department official of working for an enemy power. In each case, the guts of the defense is, how could you make such charges against an honorable person like me? Everybody knows I'm a respectable, important person. You can't say that. And there are only two small differences. The first is that the political side reverses. That Hiss is the left defending Hiss and the right attacking him. Thomas is the other way around. And what struck me was that basically the left in the Thomas case was making the arguments that the right made in his case, and the right in the Thomas case was making the arguments the left made in his case. And the other difference was that in his case there was actual physical evidence in the Thomas case that never was, and so Thomas ends up on the Supreme Court, despite the accusations against him. But what struck me about going back to the subject is that those arguably are both cases of reputational, of people who have good reputations trying to use the good reputation to defend themselves in the absence of actual evidence of what you're saying is true. His case has failed, and Thomas's case is not clear, presumably there are still lots of people who believe he was guilty. It undoubtedly weakened him in various ways. But I think that does, I think that does happen sort of not, if you don't limit it to the contract case, that the general issue of I'm an, you know, an important, respectable, famous person, so you should believe me and not him, is one which comes up in lots of different contexts. I'm trying to think of other examples. There have got to be other examples of the same sort of other people have them. So your third question was morality. And that is interesting. And I guess part of the answer is that I don't have a very good non-economic theory of morality, and I don't like to base my arguments on things I don't understand very well. I do have a sort of economic theory of it, which I've got in one of my books, which basically has to do with why it is an irrational self-interest to be the kind of person who treats well those with whom you're engaged in voluntary transactions. And this depends on the fact that people can, to a considerable degree, read the utility function of other people, so to speak. To a considerable degree, if you observe somebody for a while, you can figure out what kind of person he is. Not perfect, but con men are people really good at not being bad, but most people. And that, in general, if you imagine that you and I are engaged in something, if I'm your employee or your partner or something, as a general rule, my being somebody who acts in the interest of both of us benefits you more than it costs me. Since it benefits you more than it costs me, you are willing to offer an amount more for dealing with such people that more than compensates them for not having the opportunity to steal stuff in your pocket. I started this as a question in the book of why there are people who won't steal people if they're sure nobody's looking. And my economic answer is, provided people can tell whether you're that sort of person, that's the assumption, and I think there's good reason to believe in terms of how people actually act, it's true, then if I say we've got two employees, this time you'll be the good guy. One potential employee is somebody who I know would never steal if nobody's looking, and the other one is one who I suspect will grab anything that's not nailed down as long as you can't live. And I say two questions. One of them is, how much more am I willing to offer to you than to her for the same job? And the other is, how much poorer are you as a result of not taking up advantage of the opportunity to steal from you? And the answer is, the first number is predictably larger than the second. That, because after all, if she steals from me when I'm not looking, that has two costs. First, the stuff that she steals, that's a cost to me, which is at least as large as the benefit to her. Plus the cost to me of the efforts I make to look, to keep down the amount of that, that's a net cost that does her no good. Therefore, the loss to me of having the dishonest employee is larger than the gain to her, and therefore the difference between the wages I'm willing to offer the two is larger than the gain to the dishonest employee. Therefore, it is in your selfish interest to be the honest employee. That's the idea. So that's an economic explanation of virtue, so to speak. And as I say, it does depend on the idea that we can do a pretty good job of evaluating other people by things like facial expressions, voice tones, gestures, that in effect, each of us is giving a monologue about the inside of his head. That makes sense all the time. And you've got to be really clever to be able to be two people at once, to figure out what the nice, honest person you're pretending to be would be doing and thinking and saying, and simultaneously be running in the background after a single opportunity to cheat people. And it's harder to run two processes than one. So that would be my approach to morality. Now, there are obviously other possible approaches to morality that one they can try to make evolutionary arguments about why we've got hardwired into us the tendency to feel bad and stop certain things. It might be a very similar argument to what I just offered, but in a different context. You can make religious arguments that God implanted us with this. You can make philosophical arguments that people people think they've deduced morality in some fashion. So I agree that you, let me put it differently. You could imagine the case where there is somebody who has a good reputation, and the reason you trust him is not reputational enforcement, because you happen to know this is the last move. You happen to know he's going to go out of business after he's going to deal with you. But you say the reason he has good reputation is he's a moral guy, and he turns it to cheat people. And that's still true, even though he no longer. All right, so that seems to be another way of trying to analyze this, would be say, to what extent can we tell whether you are the kind of person for whom there are non-monetary costs to cheating? Insofar as I can tell that would be another possible solution to some of these problems. But notice that what I'm really interested in is mostly the context of arm's-length relationship. You think about the cyberspace case, where you never meet the person, you don't know the person's personality, and therefore it's going to be very hard to distinguish between the person who is honest because it's profitable and he wants to maintain his reputation, and because it's really honest. As I mentioned in one of the footnotes, there's this not terribly good but sort of interesting science fiction novel called Earthweb by Mark Siegler, which is a near future one, which is partly about the use of the internet to generate information, basically. But one of the things that's going on is that the protagonist has deliberately got two online personas, one of whom is crooked, one of whom is honest. Because he thinks he sometimes has the opportunity to sell sort of services on the gray market, as it were, which you wouldn't buy from somebody who was really honest with the attorney with the police. And other times he has the opportunity to sell services you would only buy from somebody who was honest. And so he does both. So that would be sort of an extreme case. And I'm not sure that there are people who really, I suspect there are a lot of people who are really like that. You can easily enough imagine a diplomat, say, who is a thoroughly honest, kind, and generous person to his children, to his friends, to the people around him, but is perfectly willing, if he sees an opportunity to benefit his country, to sell down the river, and to betray the ally that is supporting him, with terrible consequences for people who trust in him, but, you know, he's working for his country, not for somebody else's. So I think that people in some sense do that. They say, well, this is the group with these are the in-group. These are the people I feel really count. And those people, well, you know, they're just the external world. And you have to worry about which category you were in, whether you get shoved from one category to another when it was convenient. Other comments? Questions? Yes?
The arbitrators. So this doesn't seem like the arbitrators have a lot of the arbiters.
But of course, there's no reason to assume there's only one arbitrator.
No. So as a class.
And yeah, well, but as a class, it's sort of an odd way of putting it, because they're not a class; they're separate people.
Yeah, but I think that if arbitrators are very good at social networking,
except that if they get caught, the arbitrator suffers very large loss of ability to arbitrate thereafter.
They're
the general problem, I think, in terms of thinking of the ability of a group as if the group were a person. That the way I put it in a very different context is the manufacturer of many products, the president of the widget company, may spend his evening on his knees praying that the price of widgets goes up, but he spends his days behind the desk making it go down. Because when you produce widgets, that drives the price down. And similarly, the arbitrators as a group could do all sorts of things, but each individual arbitrator, after all, if I can show that you, as an arbitrator, cheated on their contract, well, that takes you out of the business. Gets me lots more business.
Just prevent them from ganging up on each other. I mean, what's the net arbitrators from creating funny sort of in-between groups with each other and getting on with other arbitrators?
But this sort of depends on the other people. I mean, after all, if it's perfectly clear to me that he cheated me, but you arbitrate on his side, I at least know that you're crooked. And if you do it very often, the number of people who know you're crooked increases. and I don't use you again, and maybe I talk to some of those other people, and they don't. So I don't know if it's possible. It seems to me that there are mechanisms which are going to tend to discourage that. Yep.
Does that assume that, say, arbitration, you know or are able to discern the truth? That's different than, say, if the standard for the arbitration decision is, say, convincing clarity or reasonable doubt, where the only thing you're producing for the consumers is to say, well, it's 51%, this person's involved with it.
Yeah, that would be very high. I agree. In cases where an honest arbitrator might be unsure of the answer, it's going to be very hard to identify a dishonest arbitrator. But on the other hand, an arbitrator who's only dishonest in those cases isn't doing very much damage, because all he's doing is causing people who are 49% guilty to be treated as 51% guilty. All right, let me go back to what I think isn't in the article but is relevant, which is the question of why this article is in the course. Because presumably, unless you have access to time machines, none of you are going to be doing law in Imperial China. And although some of you may be involved in cyberspace law, it's not likely to be sort of the major activity. Well, maybe you may be young enough, so it will be by the time you're near the end of your career. Not at least in the near future. Why is it interesting? And my view, at least, is that what's interesting is because a good deal of your job is staying out of court. That if you're designing a contract, if you design contracts that routinely result in litigation, you're probably doing a bad job. So if what you want to do is to design contracts where it will never pay either party to sue the other, one way of figuring out how to do that is to look at how people do design contracts when they can't sue each other. And that, from my standpoint, is sort of part of why the Chinese case in particular, where we really have some evidence of what they did, is instructive to a modern lawyer who's thinking about doing that. That's really why, why that's there. And the part of sort of what makes me suspect that some of this stuff is relevant is that I observe that there are quite a lot of contracts in which it looks as though one party, usually the buyer, is signing away all the rights he can sign away. That he's agreeing, you know, not that the other party is not liable for consequential damage, it's not liable for this. And the question is, why is that? A lot of people say, well, that's because the other party has an argument. But it's not that that's really true, but it seems to be a very common pattern, and there are, you know, incompetitive as well as non-competitive industries. The alternative is that that's because the other party has reputation, because the other party is a many times repeat player. Therefore, the court system doesn't have reputation, or to put it differently, the court system is at least an expensive, if not an unpredictable way of dealing with things, and therefore the rational consumer says to himself, I would rather trust this firm than maintain the right to sue them, which will be costly, because obviously they are going to charge me more if there is some risk that the case will give me any grounds for suing them, maybe for good or bad reasons. Therefore, my suspicion is that part of what we're observing there is the rational decision of consumers to choose reputational over legal enforcement. I might be wrong, but it seems to me that it helps make sense of the world that I look at. And as I explained in there, the basic reason why Imperial China seems to be a world without enforceable contracts is because they don't have any legal mechanism for enforcing contracts. They only have criminal law and not civil law, as far as I can tell. And cyberspace, because if my analysis is right, it's going to be harder to use the legal mechanism and easier to use the private mechanism. Do people understand the stuff about public key encryption that I discussed there? And if not, they want to have a further explanation. Okay, so, how many of you had heard of public key encryption before this? Public key encryption. So three people. All right. Because I think it's actually one of the really important technological breakthroughs of the last 40 years, and it's not very well known, although all of you would use it routinely, but you'd use it in the background via your computer is doing it, not you. But the basic, you would like to be able to transmit information that third parties can't read. Right? That's useful for all sorts of purposes. Credit card numbers, for example. And the traditional solution is that you scramble it using a key, which is instructions on how to scramble and unscramble, and the person receiving it has the same key, and he has privacy. And the problem with that is that if you don't have a secure channel for sending your message, you probably also don't have a secure channel for sending your key. And if the trusted messenger who brought the key to the person you're going to talk to was really working for the bad guys, whoever they are, then the bad guys now have your key and they're reading your message without you knowing it. And what public key encryption is a way of solving that problem, because the information to scramble and to de-scramble is different information. So that what you're doing is using a mathematical process that produces two long numbers, key A and key B. Key A is used as the information for scrambling the message, but key A can't unscramble it. Key B is used for unscrambling the message key A and scrambling. You can reverse it. You can also use key B to scramble and then key A unscrambles. So it's, as it were, two processes, each of which reverses what the other one did.
Okay.
I'm not going to try to explain the mathematics. You can look them up on the web with a little effort. Fine. But the most commonly used method depends basically on the fact that it's easy to multiply a bunch of numbers together to get a much bigger number. It is hard to factor. It's hard to take a long number and figure out what are the numbers that were multiplied together. But there are other forms. That's the RSA. That's the what underlies what's called RSA encryption, which is a very common form of public key encryption. So this does give you two things. First, it means that if you can distribute your public key, if all the people you want to talk to have your public key, you can then send the messages encrypted with the private key. They can read the messages. Right. No, we've got it backwards. If other people have your public key, they can encrypt their messages and send them to you, and only you can read them. I have that one backwards. What you can do is to encrypt messages with your private key. Now, anybody can read them, but nobody else could have written that message, and so it provides a signature, provides a way of proving the message. All right, is that logic there? And if you think about that, that's potentially a very powerful technology. I have, somewhere in one of my articles, I've got my business plan for Murder Incorporated. And this starts out with the observation that, as far as I can tell, what prevents people from having other people killed is not the price. That, judging by sort of such news stories, you see the cost of a hitman is something like the cost of a car. And most of us can afford a car. The reason that most ordinary people don't have the option of having somebody they really, really want dead killed, you know, the person you're going to inherit from, or the rival for the love of the only woman in the world you could possibly love, or something like that, is the inability of finding a reliable seller of that service. The risk will end up trying to commission an FBI agent and go to jail. I've got a solution to this problem. And the solution goes as follows. It starts out with billboards on a number of major highways. And the billboards simply can have a long number and the message write down this number. Some notice number. The next thing is an ad in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, classified ad, which is gibberish. The day after the ad appears, there is some large-scale assassination. And I decided that probably political figures aren't important enough. You probably do it at the bottom of the Academy Awards. And immediately after the assassination, a message goes to all of the news media saying, if you use the number on the billboards to decrypt the ad in gibberish in the New York Times, you will find something interesting. And what you will find is the description of the assassination posted a day before it happened. Your organization has now demonstrated to the world two things. One of them is what its public key is, and the other is that it kills people. You now go into business. You have to find some way of spreading information on how to get messages to you via relays through, preferably through servers located outside the U.S. in places where law enforcement isn't too energetic. And anybody who wants to send you a message hiring you to do an assassination knows that if worst comes to worst and the message is intercepted, nobody but you can read it because it's encrypted with your public key. Furthermore, when they receive instructions from you about how to pay them for doing the work you want done, those messages are signed with their private key. You can decrypt it with their public key, and therefore you don't through them. So you're now in business selling assassination services. So that's a nice illustration of what I refer to as a world of strong privacy, a world where online you can communicate with people with reasonable certainty that no third party is reading it, and where you can demonstrate to people your identity online. And it has good and bad features. It means that freedom of speech no longer depends on the opinion of the Supreme Court, because you can't suppress speech if you don't know who's speaking. And yet, via these mechanisms, you can have a reputation as, you know, a rabble-rouser or a holy man or a profound thinker or whatever, but the reputation is linked to your online identity, and nobody knows that you're actually, you know, a 14-year-old in Delhi or something. And so it's very interesting. If you're curious, I'm sure I've got one on my webpage. I've got one of my articles on strong privacy up. But part of what that goes with, and this would go beyond our current topics, is that there are other technologies which are leading to a greatly reduced privacy in non-cyberspace, in real space, because we've got video cameras, we're developing face recognition software, we've got databases, so one can pretty easily imagine a future not very far ahead where everything anybody does in any public place is recorded and findable. And so you have a possibility of a world where in real space we have less privacy than we've ever had, and in cyberspace we have. And that's all digression, but it's relevant to part of the reason that I thought this whole subject was interesting, because if you try to think about an online world where government is relatively impotent because it doesn't know stuff, you then start thinking about how other mechanisms can be used to do those things government does that are useful. And you can see reasons why a significant number of people might choose strong privacy, either because they want to avoid the government legal system like My Murder Incorporated, or because they're making lots of money selling services online and they live in some place where being known to make lots of money is dangerous, where, you know, the result may be your kids get kidnapped, or that the government decides to raise taxes on you or something of that sort, or that you're doing something very controversial, you're arguing for heretical views in Iran or something. So you can think of a lot of reasons why people might want the protection of being able to function in a world where you have both reputation and it. And that was part of what sort of drove my thinking about, in such a world, how do we enforce contracts? And that's what this article is really about. Questions? All right, let me go back to a point we really mentioned earlier in the context of arbitrators, but which is, I think, one of the interesting points, and that is most of the mechanisms of sort of voluntary market societies, there's a close connection between the function your action serves and the reward for that action. So if you think about you make stuff and sell it, the function is to have stuff that people value, and the reward depends on their value. And that, in a certain sense, is the normal way market societies work. And there are a couple of interesting exceptions to that. And reputational enforcement is one of them, because when something on YouTube, when you refuse to take back the goods that you sold me, even though you said it was a money-back guarantee, the reason he stops buying from you is not to punish you for cheating me. It's not because he wants to enforce good behavior, because he doesn't want to get cheated himself. And the result of that is that even if, in terms of the sort of combined interest of society, it would be a good thing for him to stop buying from you, that's not enough to make sure he'll do it. In particular, if it is significantly costly for him to figure out whether you cheated me or I cheated you, he's going to avoid both of us. That's a much cheaper solution in a world where there are lots of people you can do business with. And that means that I won't complain about your cheating me unless it's easy for other people to find out. So that means that reputational enforcement critically depends on low information cost to third parties, and that then gets into my argument. The other, I should say, important case with the same pattern is speculation. that speculators, at least economists, believe achieve a good purpose. They tend to smooth out price fluctuations. That if I can predict that grain prices for the next 3 months are going to be very high, well, say are going to be very low for the next 3 months and high for 3 months after that, I buy during the first 3 months, that tends to pull prices up. I sell during the next three, that tends to push them down. And thus, speculation in the grain market results in a net gain in the extreme case preventing famines, because if I see that it's going to be high then, buying now and storing and selling is going to do a benefit. Right. However, the reward of speculation does not depend on the benefit, because you can imagine a case where I buy some asset half an hour before its price is going to go up. So there's no significant effect on people's behavior. My driving up the price of wheat doesn't result in their growing more wheat or using less or anything of the sort, but I still make money when the price goes up. And the famous legal example is a case in New Orleans at the end of the war of 1812. I don't know if you've studied this case, but this has to do with the question basically of whether it is legal to profit by information the other side doesn't have. Because what happened was that one of the cotton traders in New Orleans somehow got word of the treaty that ended the war of 1812 some hours before everybody else did. Well, the war of 1812 meant that the British Navy was blockading New Orleans, which meant you couldn't get cotton out, which made the price of cotton in New Orleans low. So what he did was to sign a contract by which another cotton dealer sold him a lot of cotton. News reaches New Orleans, the other guy tries to renege on the contract, the court finds the contract. But that's a case where he was, in effect, speculating on cotton. Speculation didn't produce no social benefit, but made lots of money for you. So those are both sort of from the economist. Yep.
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused on your last example.
Yep.
I'm not really sure why a net benefit is produced, because the money that the speculator earns in buying just half an hour before...
There isn't. That's what I'm saying. It's a benefit for him, but not a social benefit. His benefit is entirely at the expense of the person who would have had the cotton when the price went up otherwise. But I'm saying that is not typically the case of speculation. Because in most cases, the result of speculation is the speculator, who is more farsighted than other people, which is why he can make money speculating, in effect, by his actions, transmits the information back. So that if I see there's going to be a grain shortage in 6 months, the implication of that is we would like people to produce more food now, to economize on food in various ways, maybe to slaughter their animals and turn them into sausages instead of eating the grain, that sort of thing. By my speculating driving up the price of grain, I give other people incentive to do that. So that's a real benefit. But my point is that my profit is not, as in the normal case of making goods and selling them, my profit doesn't depend on that benefit. Because I can still make the profit even in the case where that benefit goes to zero.
My follow-up question would be that, like, as you were saying, that if speculators are more far-sighted and they transmit that information to the rest of us who are not as far-sighted, yet. But if they're wrong, like, if they're wrong,
then they lose money.
Right, but everyone else could lose money too.
Absolutely.
Because they're going to transmit wrong information, yes, which can cost revenues.
That's right. So, but the speculators who are still around and have lots of money to speculate with tend to be the ones who guess right. That's the argument. Anyway, but in the case of, I just find it intriguing as an economist that you sort of got this picture of what makes the world work, how you coordinate in a decentralized way hundreds of millions of people, and 98% of it has one logic, which is you do something valuable to other people and you get rewarded by them for doing it, and 2% has a different logic. You do something and you get rewarded, and it's valuable to other people. When the reward has nothing to do with the value of the other people. Makes sense. All right. So then let's go back to what a good deal of the article is about, which is how you structure a contract in such a way that it's never in the interest of either party to breach. All right. And that's only part of the question of how you structure a contract to pay out the courts, because you might go into the court for some reason other than the breach, obviously. But if you take the breach one, and then I think we've already discussed the simple answer, which is that you try to time the payments by one side in such a way that at each point along the process, both sides would lose by breach. And that's without enforcement, so that means breach with everybody just holding on to what he's got. So if you imagine the case where you're building the house on my property, and I'm worried that if I pay you in advance, you'll just go leave with the money, and you're worried that if I pay you when it's finished, I'll refuse to pay you when you're finished, and the house is sitting on my land, so what can you do with it? Then I pay you over time in such a way that when we come to the last hour, it's worth my paying you the last $5,000 because the work to do in that last hour will make the house, you know, ready to be moved into, which is worth more than $5,000 to me. And from your standpoint, that last $5,000 is somewhat more than it'll cost you to do that last piece of work, so it's worth your staying with the contract fee. Does that make sense? That's sort of the logic in the simple case. And the first observation is the bigger the total gain from the contract, the easier this is to do. That if completion of the contract leaves both the two of us on net $100,000 worth or better off, then it's pretty easy to structure the contract so that there's no point at which breaching leaves us better off. That gets much harder, though, if you imagine the limiting case, which is a contract where, like, speculative or buying in advance, where we're really making a bet, and once things have turned out, my gain is equal to your loss. All right, just imagine a bet on a football game. That's a contract, if you like. When we make it, it's in both of our interests because we have different opinions on what's going to happen in the game. But once the game is played, everything the winner gains, the loser loses. So that's going to be very hard to structure. And if you think about the example that I mentioned in the book, which is a real example from the Chinese case, I am buying goods which you're going to deliver in 6 months, and we're agreeing on the price now. Well, if the cost to me of switching to another supplier is very high, then if the market price of the good goes down a significant amount, I would like to renege on the contract and buy from somebody else. On the other hand, if you could easily find other buyers, then if the price of the goods on the market goes up very much in the next 6 months, you'd like to renege on the contract and sell it at a higher price to someone else. Does that make sense? Well, if what we're worried about is the price going down, then if I pay a deposit, I'll forfeit the deposit if I renege. So that means that unless it goes down a lot, I won't renege on the contract. Does that make sense? So that suggests that by who makes deposits to whom, you can, as it were, shift the incentive to renege between the parties. But the problem is that if you don't have a big margin, if during most of the contracts, during some parts of the contract, neither party is very much better off by completion, then any shifting that makes me less likely to breach the contract makes you more likely. I've given a deposit to you, and you hold on to the deposit if things break down, and there's no court adjudicating the matter, then you have a temptation in situations where breach doesn't look too bad to you to breach and just hold on to the deposit as a problem. So that's the problem. Make sense? And one interesting solution that I discuss is the use of a hostage instead of a deposit. And everybody understand the logic of a hostage? What's the difference between a hostage and a deposit? Yep.
The hostage is only valuable to one party, to the person giving it.
That's right.
But the problem I had with the article actually acknowledged, but then just kind of proceeded onward.
Is what prevents the other party from insisting you buy back the hostage?
The idea that once a party has the hostage, that they could extort the other party. Because if I have your...
But the most they can extort the other party for is the value of the hostage.
Which is potentially a lot, though.
Yeah, but the least they can extort the other party for is the value of the other party. And that value to them. Think about it as a bilateral monopoly bargain. All right? I've got the world's only apple. I don't like apples. You like apples. They're worth a dollar to you. You can't predict that you're going to pay a dollar.
Unless that they believe you, you have a reputation for killing hostages, which doesn't seem like a hard thing to garner.
Well, if you have a reputation for extorting the hostages, you're going to have a hard time getting people to sign contracts with you. My usual hostage story, which I tell you because it's a good story, although I don't know how much it adds to this, is a historical one. Have any of you ever heard of a man called William Marshall? No reason you should have. William Marshall was born in, I suppose it would be the early 12th century, probably. He was the fourth son of a minor noble in England, and before he died, he was regent of England. In between, he was probably the top tournament knight in Western Europe. He was a man who probably regarded Richard the Lionhearted as a talented amateur. And William, early on, this story is when William was a child. William's father, as you may or may not know, a couple of generations after the Norman Conquest, there's a civil war in England between the partisans of Stephen and Matilda. Basically, the king dies with no sons but a daughter. And he swears everybody in sight to support his daughter. I think the idea was not that she would be ruler, because I don't think that their system allowed a ruling queen at that point, but that her son when he grew up or something, would be the king. And unfortunately for her, his nephew, I think, Stephen, is closer to London when the king dies. His brother is, I think, the Archbishop of Canterbury, if I remember correctly, and crowns him king. So there's then about a 14-year-long, rather unpleasant civil war between two sides over who's going to eventually succeed. And William Marshall's father, Gilbert Marshall, by the standards of that civil war, was an honorable man. He only switched sides once. He starts out fighting for Stephen, is then bought off by Matilda, and fights on Matilda's side. And at one point during the war, Stephen shows up in front of Gilbert's castle with an army and says, "Please surrender your castle to me. I've got a big army, you know." Gilbert says, "Well, yeah, you've got a big army, but you know it's going to take you quite a lot of time, and every castle's been what castles are like to take this castle. I got a deal for you. And the deal is that you let me send a message to Matilda asking her to bring an army to relieve your siege. If she doesn't show up with a relieving army in 3 days, I agree to surrender." And Stephen says, "Sounds like a good deal to me, but why should I trust you to keep your side of it? We've got this, there isn't any court that's going to enforce contracts in the middle of the Civil War." And Gilbert says, "That's all right, I'll give you my son." So he hands over William, who is one of his sons, to Stephen. Stephen takes his army off to do something else for 3 days. And Gilbert, who knows as well as Stephen does that Matilda has no army close enough to be of any use, spends 3 days hiring troops, bringing in supplies, and getting ready for a siege. Stephen shows up in front of the army and says, "All right, 3 days gone, surrender." And Gilbert says, "Ha ha, fooled you." And Stephen says, "I'll kill the kid." And Gilbert says, "Have I not? Three more? And besides, I have still the hammer and the anvil with which to forge another." And Stephen, in the story at least, makes various sort of gestures in the direction of killing William, but Stephen is too tender-hearted a man for somebody fighting a civil war in England in the 12th century, and eventually lets the boy live, and he goes on to have this quite extraordinary, brilliant career in feudal England in the 12th century. He's regent after King John dies. One of the things that you probably don't know from your high school history is that when John died, there was a French army in London commanded by the Dauphin, the heir to the crown of France, in alliance with the barons who were in rebellion against King John. So it was Magna Carta and all that stuff. And John dying asks the people around him to ask William Marshall, who by this time was an important feudal lord for various reasons, having married very well, to take over as regent for his son. And William accepts the job, and in 6 months the French are back in France, everything is at peace, he goes home and dies, he's an old man, but that's why he's regent. Anyway, but it's my favorite hostage story, so even if it's irrelevant, I think my bits and things that are taking. So, let me see, I had some more notes here. Let me see what I wanted to say about this stuff. So the hostage is certainly one possible solution. And as I mentioned in the article,
the very best hostage is the one which only works if you're guilty. And my two examples of that are either criminal accusations in China or attacks on reputation.
in our society. You ask the question, why, when you cheat, do I go to all the trouble of defaming you, as it were? Well, one reason might be I want the reputation to be a bad guy to cheat against, but another, in a sense, related reason is to say, that's the hostage that I've just destroyed, your reputation. You gave me hostage because you did things in such a way that I could demonstrate to other people you could behave badly. And similarly, in the Chinese case, when I go to the district magistrate, I know there's some risk that I'll get in trouble because it's not a very pleasant legal system, but there are a lot of risks to you in being charged with cheating me, and therefore I'm willing to do that as in retaliation, as it were, for your cheating. Let's see what else. All right, so as I've already suggested, a different solution. One solution is to use deposits or hostages to make sure that there is never a time when either party is better off by breaching. Failing that, the other one is to say, all right, there are reputational incentives not to breach. Put the risk of breach on whoever has the strongest reputational incentives not to. So if you're a repeat player with highly high visibility, reputation is important to you, then I trust you, you don't have to trust me. And vice versa. Yeah. I think if you look at the way we ordinarily do business, that when you buy stuff, especially online or by mail order, you give them the money, and at some future point you get the stuff. So basically, now it's true you could sue them for small amounts, nobody is likely to bother, but the more important thing is that you trust that beans or the sharper image or whoever you deal with will send you the stuff because they don't want the reputation for cheating their customers and which they will get otherwise. They don't have to. They don't trust you. They correctly don't trust you. You're not a repeat player, and therefore if you say, send me the stuff, when I get it, I'll send you the money, they say, sorry, we don't do business that way. So I think it explains those. The other do people find this convincing or not? I can't tell. And the one way, yep.
I'm not sure I understand how to incorporate this on a contract-by-contract basis as a general principle in the notion of reputation seems convincing. But on the other hand, how do you write into your contract? Well, okay, I'll really discourage your reputation.
No, what you can write into your contract is which you have to trust the other. In designing your contract, the question is, how important to you is it to design it in such a way that the other side can't engage in opportunistic breach? Because it's going to cost something. If you think in our context, we've got two contracts in which I'm agreeing to do something for you. One of them is designed in such a way that in one of them is designed in a way which gives me an opportunity to cheat you, and one of them which gives you an opportunity to cheat. I'm going to require a higher payment to agree to a contract where you have an opportunity to cheat me than one the other way around. Are you willing to make that payment? Take the case where there's no good way of making sure that either of us can cheat. And in that case, you would like to ask, is the other party a repeat player with a reputation such that he has good reasons not to cheat aside from the contract? If he is, then you aren't willing to pay a very high price to get the contract written in a way in which he can't cheat you and you can cheat him. Does that make sense? Yeah.
An example that comes to mind is like buying electronics from a shabby internet store.
Right.
It's like half price.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to weigh as a consumer whether you want to take that risk.
And if you wanted to start a business, take Overstock.com, which is a big organization now. If you want to start a business like that, to break into that market, you want to think about, how can I structure my deals so people don't have to trust me? Can I do it in the form of their payment goes to some reliable intermediary, American Express or something? who agrees that they will hold the money for 10 days and only turn it over to me if you report that the goods are delivered, etc. And of course, the big example of that now is eBay. All right, if you look at how eBay works, I will always regret that I didn't know more about eBay earlier, because I would have invested in their stock, but I didn't, in fact. Because I would have seen that they were deliberately structuring reputational mechanisms such that you could buy from strangers, which is what's happening on eBay, and yet, if there are large amounts, they had escrow arrangements available so that you didn't have to trust people for small amounts. They've got easy ways if you're reporting on your reputational experience. That was a sensible way of doing it. So I guess that would be an example. That particular business, I think part of what made it work was their thinking about these issues. Yep. Another question. Yep.
Does this apply in situations like, say, inspecting a company and looking at their trade secrets where it's difficult to determine whether or not they've actually appropriated those trade secrets? And even if you had a hunch that they stole your trade secrets, it'd be difficult to prove.
I'm not sure. Explain, as I understand what trade secrets are, but explain what's the context you're thinking about.
So let's say a company's considered by another company, and the value is in their trade secrets.
And you don't know if they really own them or not.
Right. So you have to disclose them so they can determine the value.
Right.
But then this company who's inspecting the trade secrets can just take it for themselves.
And therefore, if you were thinking about selling your company to another company, you would want a company which you were pretty sure wouldn't do that. And that would, for example, a company that was often engaged in such transactions would have a strong incentive not to have a reputation of stealing trade secrets, right? That if they stole your trade secrets and you then sued them, whether or not you won, that would make it harder in the future for them to acquire companies. Way. Whereas if you're dealing with a company where this is the only time they'll ever do that, then they may be less concerned about that kind of reputation. Yeah. But similarly, you think about dealing with governments, presumably there are going to be some kinds of governments where you're going to say, well, look, they don't care about the reputation, right? You know, we know we can't sue them, and they know it. And there will be other ones, if you think about, say, Swiss bank secrecy rules kinds of things, where they've got quite a strong reason to try to keep that reputation. Fought pretty hard for it. Not always successful. But, all right, let me go on, because we're talking really about mainly the issue of breach and cheating. But the other thing that you might think about is setting up the contract so that the outcome you want to happen will happen without a court getting involved. And the two simple examples of that. One of them is caveat emptor. If we say, I am selling this to you with no warranty, and the agreement is that if it breaks down an hour after you buy it, you should have looked at it more carefully before you bought it, you've got no legal rights against it. That there are advantages and disadvantages to doing it that way. But one advantage of doing it that way is that neither side would have to hire any lawyers. Right? So that in general, structuring the contract so that losses remain where they fall, as it were, is a benefit. It's not an unlimited benefit. There are sometimes reasons not to do it, but it's a benefit because it then means that when something goes wrong short of breaching the contract, you don't have to go to court. You just say, all right, too bad. I'm going to have to write that off because they had an investment. Another example of the same thing, and one which was the case in the Chinese one. The Chinese system did have pretty strong caveat. Do people know what caveat emptor means? Let the buyer beware. It means that the seller is not warranting the product. When Father Goda was still here, I don't see you, hopefully you've been here long enough, you remember him, very nice fellow. Whenever the weather was unusually bad in this area, I used to go into his office and tell him that I felt that the South Bay was in violation of warranty. Since he was the representative of the responsible party, it was necessary to warn him of any legal action. The weather always got better, so it worked. But he was a very tolerant man, probably still. But that, of course, as you can understand, that's the kind of warranty, that's the implicit warranty due to. There's some technical legal term that you keep doing things in a certain way long enough, you establish a legally binding expectation in other people. they're determined. I mean, that's the basis for the warranty, whether it's that day. But in any case, but if you think about the fact that one of the rules in the Chinese system was that ownership went with possession. So they did not normally have contractual forms in which the stuff is in your warehouse, but it now belongs to me. As we obviously could do nowadays and quite often do. In fact, I've got a whole bunch, a sizable fraction of my total assets are stuff that belongs to me, but where the relevant pieces of paper are sitting with Merrill Lynch, because I have a money market account, and the money market account is one where your stocks belong to you, not to them, but are held by them. And that's fine if you have an enforceable legal system, or if you're really sure you can trust Merrill Lynch, not so fine if you don't. And so the usual Chinese rule was if they got it, it's theirs. Obviously, if you stole it, breaking the criminal law, and that therefore ownership transfers at the point of physical possession transfer. There are advantages to that because it means that the owner has an incentive to take care of stuff. It avoids the issue where it was your stuff, it was in my warehouse, the roof leaked, the stuff was spoiled, tough luck, and or robbers came in or things of that sort. If the rule is simple, as long as I have control over it, it's mine, then I still take the loss if you don't. So that would be one way of doing it. I think there was anything else that I wanted to discuss that we haven't yet since. So, any more comments, questions, things you want to discuss?
All right. I think our next topic is going to be accounting. And accounting is the one topic that I had to learn as a result of teaching this course, knowing nothing at all about it. And let me see if I can tell you anything useful about accounting. Accounting is a very simplified way of trying to produce financial information about firms, basically. Information such as how much is this firm worth, how did it do last year, and so forth. And the underlying problem in doing that is that the people who hired the accountants often have reasons to want the information to turn out in one way or another. So if I'm the CEO or of a company and the company is really doing very badly, and if it's known that it's doing badly, my stock will go down and I might get fired by the board of directors and such. So therefore, I have an incentive to hire an accountant who will make things look as good as possible. And given that situation, the reason I'm making this point is that I think a lot of things in accounting would make no sense if you didn't know that. That if you just said, if the accountant was trying to give the best estimate he could of the value of the company, he would not follow many of the accounting rules. That what those rules are designed to do is to constrain his decision in order to reduce the amount of flexibility he has in order to reduce his ability to devise those rules. And to take one example out of many, but one of the most striking ones, under most circumstances, assets of a corporation are priced at what they cost to obtain. So if the corporation owns a chunk of land, and this land was bought 50 years ago for $10,000, the normal accounting rule is it's a $10,000 asset. It may really be a $10 million asset, depending on what's happened to the real estate price. But you couldn't tell if it's $10 million or $5 million without, you know, quite extensive research, and therefore we simply have a rule which says you've got to break it down to $10,000. You know, the president of the company can tell a potential investor you want to know that this is and so forth, but the accounting figures won't show. Similarly, another one which I found striking is that in accounting as a tort law, all probabilities are one or zero. You see the sense in which that's true in tort law. Right? Yep.
Well, this is just a guess, but either you like, most people conceive of it as 50% negligent, 75% negligent, 25% negligent, but at the end of the day, either you're negligent or you're not.
And there are exceptions. There are bits of tort law and some rules about comparative negligence.
The sort of the basic rule, not only for tort law, for criminal law too, is you're guilty or innocent. All right? If the odds are 55% that you're guilty, you're innocent in criminal law. If the odds are 50% that you're guilty in tort law, All right, two different rules, but both rules have this characteristic of one to make a binary classification. In both cases, it makes a good deal of sense because given that people are going to be fighting over these things, we don't want to have a case where it's 34% or 35%. No. As long as it's not close to the margin, we can just write it one way or the other. Similar to the accounting rule, if your company's been sued and if you lose, you're going to pay $1 million. The standard accounting rule is if you're more likely than not to lose, that's $1 billion liability. If you're more likely than not to win, that's a zero. And again, I think the argument is the same. So I think it helps in understanding. There are other things, as if you haven't done accounting before, you'll see parts of it are bizarre and confusing. But I think most of them make logical sense in the internal system of a sort of almost a toy way of calculating things designed to be as strange as possible. The other thing which you should be warned about is that the words credit and debit exist only for the purpose of confusing people who are trying to understand accounting. That the first approximation is that if you think it's a credit, it's probably a debit. If you think it's a debit, it's probably a credit. But they aren't as consistent as to make that always the case. And eventually you can work out the logic of why some things are called credits and debits, but probably you should do that at the end and not at the beginning. And it becomes, in a formal sense, you're writing diagrams, and the credits are one side of the line and the debits are on the other side, and you can often figure out why something belongs where it does on the line without figuring out whether it is. Because credits sound like a good thing and a debit and a bad thing, but in fact not uncommonly together. All right. So that's a brief introduction to what we do next time.
And I think I'm going to give all of us an extra 4 minutes because I can't have anything else to say.